Deuteronomy chapter 32, read verses 11 and 12. As an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings, taketh them, baileth them on her wings. So the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. This couple of verses is simply the most illustrative, if you like, the most clear and vivid picture that the Lord paints through the mouth of Moses here of his own care of his people Israel. The rest of the chapter, much of the chapter, is concerning both the Lord's loving care of them, but their rejection of him throughout the 40 years in the wilderness. This, remember, is Moses' almost parting shot. If we were to look ahead to the end of Deuteronomy, if we were Deuteronomy 32, if we were to see verse 47, where he says, "It's not a vain thing for you, because it is your life, and through this thing you shall prolong your days in the land whither you go over Jordan to possess it." He is, after he's sung the song in verse 44, Moses came and spake all the words of this song in the ears of the people, and Hoshea, the son of Nun, that's Joshua. And so after he's completed it and explained to them, they have to adhere to what they're being taught here. Then the Lord spake to Moses the seventh same day, saying, "Get thee up into this mountain Abarim, and unto Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, that is over against Jericho, and behold the land of Canaan, which I gave unto the children of Israel for possession, and die in the mount whither thou goest up, and be gathered unto thy people, as Aaron thy brother died in Mount Hor, and was gathered unto his people." So this is, although he still has opportunity and time to bless each of the 12 tribes in chapter 33, this is Moses' parting shot. He is given this, the inspiration of this song, in order to declare to the people the nature of their relationship to the Lord. And this picture of the eagle is simply, as we say, the most vivid illustration out of the rest of the description that he gives in this chapter 32. Let's think about the eagle for a moment. We mentioned with the children a few moments ago how the eagle takes care of its young. First of all, when the eagles meet together and mate, they are monogamous, in the sense that when an eagle, certainly a golden eagle, mates with its partner, it does so for life. They will stay together as a couple until one of them dies. And season by season, they will bring forth their young. And usually the mother will lay approximately 4 eggs, of which 1 or 2 might survive and live. And while she's caring for them, the father eagle will go out and do most of the hunting. About 80% of all the items that are brought to the nest, it's the father eagle that does it, the male eagle that does it. About 90% of the biomass that is brought, and which is brought them, that's again the father that does it, while the mother is caring for the eagles. After they hatch, initially when the shell just cracks, it's quite some time, quite a few days, sometimes weeks, before they're completely out of the shell, and then they're just prostrate, they're just helpless, they lie flat on the base of the nest, and they're completely bald, of course, they can't do anything. And so they are kept warm by one or other of the parents basically nestling over them to keep them warm, to protect them, until they're able, with feeding and so on, finally to sit up a wee bit after a few weeks, and then to sit up properly, and then to be fed with a wee beaks going as the food is brought to them, and so on. They gain strength, and they gain a bit of plumage, and then eventually, when the time comes, they are able to be ejected, as it were, from the nest in the nicest possible way, not just kicked out, but rather when they are out of the nest, which is usually set up very high on some kind of rock or a little cave or something for great security, because the eagles care very much for the safety of their young. Then as they drop, they are able to spread their little wings a little bit, but they can't do much flapping. So this is partly what it means here. Eagle stirreth up her nest. She makes it, fluffs it up so that it's warm for them. She protects her young. She fluttereth over her young, keeping them with the feathers of her wings, keeping them, protecting them, making sure they're warm. And when it comes to flying, she spreadeth abroad her wings. And this is a reference to the fact that when they are still young, the eagle, in spreading its wings, the young will rest on either end of the wing, and then she'll tip slightly one way or the other, and they'll drop, of course, and they'll begin to glide, or they'll begin to learn how to soar, or whatever, but they won't have a lot of strength, and she's not just going to let them drop when they run out of strength. Then she'll come up underneath them, and pick them up again, as it were, on her wings. And this way, they will learn by experience how to fly. Little by little, she will bear them on her wings. This is what it's a reference to. She fluttereth over her young, she spreadeth abroad her wings and takes them, beareth them on her wings. So the Lord alone did lead him, that is Israel. And sometimes, of course, as we said, she'll tip. She'll tip one way or the other, and they'll drop. And there's a tendency for Israel, or for us, as those who seek to follow the Lord, that when we feel ourselves dropping, then, oh, the Lord's abandoned us. Oh, he's forgotten us. Oh, he doesn't care about us. But all he's doing is he is enabling us to learn to spread the wings, to gain strength by experience. And he is always ready to swoop, as it were, beneath us to bear us up again. Underneath, truly, are the everlasting arms. The Lord does not abandon his people, but he does train them up in the way that they should go. He does protect them. He has great care of them. So we mentioned, you know, with the children, that the speeds at which eagles can fly, can glide, can dive, are unmatched by any other bird except possibly the peregrine falcon, which is, of course, a much smaller bird. So this makes the eagle one of the fastest creatures on the planet. It's said, of course, the eagle can look directly into the sun. There's various other attributes that it's got. For such a cruel looking bird, with its hooky beaks and its great big talon, it takes enormous tender care of its young. It is incredibly gentle with its young. And so likewise the Lord, who may seem as though he is cruel, he's not cruel, but may seem as though he is wrathful against sin, which of course he is. He is absolutely unrelenting in his wrath and his judgment against sin, and yet his tender care of his own children is unparalleled. The eagle is that which can soar higher than any other creature, and God is higher than the eagle, can go faster than almost any other creature, but nothing is as the speed of the Lord, who when he comes is as the lightning that shines from the east even unto the west. The highest, most capable creature that everybody sort of wants to be. Everybody wants a share in this. Think of all the sort of empires of the world. You know, think of the Roman Empire. What do they make on top of their standards? They make an eagle, because everybody wants a piece of this kind of greatness. They want the share in its speed and its power and its ability. When Napoleon Bonaparte was leading the French Empire, what did they have on the tops of their standards? The Napoleonic eagle. In the Eastern Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and the Russians, of course, and their Tsarist Empire, what did they have? They had a double-headed eagle, sort of a mythical creature, obviously, but it was meant to be one which looked both east and west. But again, it's the eagle. And an awful lot of countries and nations use the eagle as a heraldic symbol, because it has that strength and power that everybody wants to kind of plug into. And of course, more recently, the Third Reich used it as well in the Second World War and before that. So whether the connotations are negative or positive, it is a creature that everybody kind of wants to be like. But God is greater than the greatest eagle. This is what he is trying to convey to them. That he is, as we see in verse 4, the rock. Now, a rock is, in a sense, more powerful, more strong, stable than the eagle, because it is to the rock that the eagle goes when it wants to make its nest. He is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are judgment, a God of truth, and without iniquity, just and right. And there is a contrast between verse 4 and verse 5. He is the rock. They, Israel, have corrupted themselves. He is the rock. He's perfect and just and righteous. They have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. Now, what do they mean by this spot? Well, there's two ways of looking at this. There's the physical and material, and there's the more spiritual sense. In the physical sense, it's probably a reference to the fact that the pagans, or those who worship other gods, tended to mark themselves, paint themselves either with circles or oval shapes or different kind of markings or tattoos. It probably wasn't quite like the tattoos we have nowadays where the ink goes underneath the skin, but they painted themselves, they marked themselves with these spots or circles or whatever, depending on the different kind of deity or god that they worshipped. And he says, their spot that they have is not the spot of his children. They don't have the markings of the children of God. They're a perverse and crooked generation. You know, and of course the Lord in Leviticus prohibited his children from making such similar markings in themselves. Leviticus 19:28, we shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, nor print any marks upon you. I am the Lord. Which, of course, you could take as being a divine prohibition on the tattoo nowadays. But the point is that their markings are those of false gods. They bear, as it were, the marks of false gods in them. That's in the physical sense. Now, if we're looking in the spiritual sense, there's a recognition here that everybody has spots, blemishes, false sins. But there's a difference between those who are seeking to love and serve the Lord and yet fail, and yet fall and stumble and do commit sin, and they hate that sin and they repent of it and they want to try better, and yes, they keep sinning again the next day, but it's not what they want to do. They want to be the Lord's. But you know, as Paul says in Romans 7, the good that I would I do not, but the evil that I would not that I do. That's the kind of spot that the children of the Lord have. They have spots, they have blemishes, they have sins, they have a spiritual spot, a spiritual blemish, day by day. But they don't love it, they hate it, they keep falling into it, they keep sinning it. And yes, there's part of them in the fleshly sense that loves it, but they really want to turn from it. But their spots is not as the spot of his children, in the sense that this is a proud, deliberate sin. This is a perversity. As it says later on in the chapter, it says, do ye thus requite the Lord, O foolish people, and unwise? Is not he thy father that hath bought thee? Hath he not made thee and established thee? See, even in this verse here, thy father, first of all, this Old Testament reference to God as father. It's not just Jesus in the Lord's Prayer who kind of invented that idea. Is not thy father that bought thee? Here's the sense of their redemption, being bought back from sin. It doesn't say, you know, simply made you. It goes on to say made you. First of all, he had created you. But not enough that he created you, he also bought you back from the sin in which you were by nature and established you. He settled you. He gave you everything you needed. Remember the days of old and all that he did. But the sin of Israel and of all who thus turn away from the Lord says, you know, Jeshurun, verse 15, Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. The sense here is of a sort of pet beast, whether it were a horse or a sheep or a ram or whatever, that had been sort of fed like a pet from when it was little. It had been spoiled, basically. Now, there's two ways that such a spoiled pet might react. It might be constantly kind of grateful and loving and affectionate and so on, or it might just become spoiled and just demanding and just kick out and lash out at the hand that feeds it. And this is the sense of it here. Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked like an agricultural creature that had been taken in as a pet, that had been sort of hand-fed and hand-reared and spoiled. And now it was just kicking out, lashing out at the hand that fed it. Thou art waxing fat, thou art grown thick, thou art covered with fatness. In other words, began to think, well, I'm strong enough myself. I'm good enough myself. Look at the land in which I dwell. Look at the richness of the fields. Look at all that I have here. My own hand hath gotten me this. And it's the sense in which the more the Lord blesses, the more Israel turns away from him, thinking, this is my good, this is my strength. And this is very much like the heart of modern man as well. Because when a disaster happens, when something bad or tragic or harrowing occurs, people shake their fist at heaven and say, how can you believe in a God of love that would do this? How can a God of justice do this? Is this God's will? Oh, what an evil God you must believe in. And yet when they look around at all the good in the world, all the blessings that they enjoy, all the riches, all the luxury in which they live, they don't turn around and say, what a good God, actually, that's given me all these things. What a kind God that's blessed us with abundance of food and drink, and that when we're ill or when an accident happens, there's hospitals and doctors and nurses that we can go to. They don't think, oh, what a good God it is that has provided this. Only when something is wrong, something outside of their control, then they are ready to blame God for that. They provoked him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations provoked they into anger, they sacrificed unto devils. Now, of course, they might or might not think that they are actually worshipping devils. They might just invent gods of their own. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Because anything that we worship or anything that we give power or glory to, which is other than God, it's only the devil that is ultimately benefiting. But there is a sense, of course, in which there is a perverseness, as it says here, with human nature. They behave themselves strangely, verse 27. Fear not his wrath. They behave themselves strangely, and they were against the Lord with this perverseness that desires to do that which is forbidden simply because it is forbidden. Talking about worship of devils for a minute. Let me think for a moment. If somebody wants you to think that they're really some really bad, wicked person, oh, you better be careful of me, because look how they'll put marks or t-shirts or tattoos or whatever of death's heads, skulls with sort of screaming skull heads and long flowing hair, things stabbed with knives and blood coming out of them, as though it's really sort of devilish. And make you think, ooh, they must be a really bad person. Ooh, we better be scared of them. And they're trying to sort of attract, this is how bad I am. This, you better be scared of me. You better give me respect. What are they looking for? Are they looking for the fear of men? Are they looking to suddenly think, ooh, scary? And what is it that the fear of man affords? Is it respect? God is ready to give them respect. God is ready to give them love for who they are, but they don't want that. Man, in his fallen nature, has a perversity which will sometimes literally glorify the devil because it's as bad as he can be. And there's a part of him that desires to be as bad can be, so that he will shock people. So that they will think, ooh, scary, and oh, how powerful he must be that he can walk with the devil, sort of thing. And all they are fooling is themselves. The devil just sits back and lets them play their games, knowing that at the end of the day, they'll be drawn down to hell with him. And then it won't be glamorous, and then it won't be tough, and then it won't be fear and respect from men. It'll just be ongoing agony for all eternity. They sacrificed unto devils. Verse 17, not to God. And of course, this is what Paul says about the Corinthian pagans. He says, you know, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 20, I say the things which the Gentiles sacrificed, they sacrificed to devils and not to God. Now, of course, they weren't saying that they worshipped devils. They were saying they worshipped Venus and Saturn and Caesar and Jupiter and all these other Roman gods or Greek versions of the same gods, but they are devils. False gods are those whom the devil wants you to worship. They sacrifice the devils and not to God. I would not that you should have fellowship with devils. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the table of devils. And likewise in Revelation chapter 9 and verse 20, and the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not of the works of their hands that they should not worship devils. And the idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders and so on. There is a perverseness in man that desires to be just as bad as it can be. To do that which is forbidden just because it's forbidden. Just to see what will happen. Just to see what people's reaction will be. But God, who already knows the end from the beginning, God, who already knows what the end of these things will be, wants to say to his children, to Israel, to us, now look, that is just dumb. That is just stupidity. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, and that they would understand their latter end. To desire to live without the Lord now in time
is simply that which you will be granted, your wish, for eternity. But eternity without God will not be like living in this world without God, because this world is a mixture of God and of the devil at work. It is a mixture of good and evil. There are good people in this world. There are good things that happen in this world. Rain comes down to cool and soothe and moisten the land, even as it does this morning. It just literally drops down out the sky, fresh water that supplies all the needs of nature. There's none of that in heaven. In hell, I beg your pardon. Where, if you remember Jesus' illustration, in Luke 16, where the rich man cries to Abraham to dip his finger in water, let Lazarus dip his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm tormented in this way, and there's no refreshing showers that will soothe or cool in a lost eternity. It is in eternity, it is either completely good and blessing and holy, because it is the undiluted work of God, or it is completely devilish, hellish, and a torment of eternity. Here there's a mixture. And so people think, I can live without God in this world and it's okay. But the only reason this world is okay is because God is at work in it, and because there is good in it. And Israel would not see, and we so often will not see. Oh, that they were wise, verse 29, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. The Lord has cared for his children as the eagle cares for her young. In Exodus 19, he already made reference to this at verse 4. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bear you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now, how the eagle will deal with its own young, as we said, is tender, it is gentle, it is self-giving of itself. Whether it's the mother or the father eagle, they will go to great lengths to protect, to help, to rear, to nurture their young. But you look at an eagle's beak and at its talents and at the strength and the speed and the power that it is in its body and its design, and you don't want to be on the wrong side of that eagle. If you're one of its young, that's great. You've got all that power and all that strength and all that sort of weaponry of its entire body is protecting you. But if you happen to be another creature on the ground, another creature which is potential prey, or which might be food or attacked or whatever, then you ought to be afraid. Because if something is diving out the sky at 200 miles an hour, you're not going to stand a chance against it. When you think of the strength and the talents that will sweep up that rodent or that creature from off the ground, and having hit it at that kind of speed, probably the impact alone probably knocks the creature out. They just don't know what's coming. And if this is what one of God's creatures is like, what much more is the Creator like? You know, in the Proverbs, Solomon himself says, there will be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not: the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Now, what is the common denominator in all of these things? There is that which is invisible. When the eagle is in the air, you can't see that by which he or she is borne up. It just soars there in the sky. And then when it dives at its prey, it does so from a position of invisibility. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock. How does it move on the rock? It crawls in its belly, yes, and it may strike from out of a rock, but the way of a serpent upon the rock is an amazing thing. We can't see how it moves. We can't see the mechanism by which its body is able to go when there's no earth to go down into. The way of a ship in the midst of the sea, that which is hidden below the waves, is that by which it is driven. In the olden days, of course, it was all sail power. You can't see the wind. You can't see that which drives the ship, how it turns this way and that, how it continues to be held up in the on the surface of the sea. There is that which is invisible, which makes it a wondrous thing. And the way of a man with a maid. What is the power of love? That which is invisible, that which determines why one person falls hopelessly head over heels with one person and not with another, with somebody else who might be eminently more suitable in many ways, much more appropriate qualities or characteristics that would match you up much better, but you can't help your heart, you fall head over heels with somebody completely different, and perhaps they do with you too, but nobody can understand that thing which is the power, the amazing thing of love, the way of a man with a maid. Nobody can enter into the depths of that. It is, in a sense, invisible. And the Lord's care and wonder for his children is a thing which in physical depth is invisible. And yet we know that he does it. We see the effects of what he does. As an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings, taketh them, beareth them on her wings, so the Lord alone did lead him. And there was no strange God with him. Nobody else looked after Israel the way the Lord did. Nobody else had the power to protect them as an eagle protects her young. No one else had the power to destroy armies and enemies that came against them as an eagle can destroy the prey or any creatures that may threaten or attack their young. The eagle is the greatest protection that her young has. And the Lord is the greatest protection that his children have. So the Lord alone did lead him. There was no strange God with him. Whatever we invent as our gods or our priorities in this world, they have no eternal value. Our jobs are great, perhaps, if we enjoy them, but they are there for a purpose, which is, yes, that we may work, which is a good, healthy thing to do, that they may provide us with sufficient income with which to live, to keep our bodies going. But our job or our career has no eternal value. And likewise, our hobbies, or the things that we may pour so much of our attention into, or the accumulation of our bank balances, has no eternal value. But your immortal soul, that has eternal value. Oh, that they were wise, verse 29, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. One little thing I want us to notice in passing is that verses 13 and 14 and 15, he talks about how he brought them into high places of the earth. This is almost certainly a reference to the fact that they were at this stage on the eastern side of Jordan, where there are the high sort of plateaus of grasslands, which are very, very good for, which were in those days anyway, very, very good for flocks and herds and so on. It's why the Reubenites and the Gadites wanted to stay that side of the river, because they had flocks and herds for pasture land. It was great for pasture land, the high places of the earth, that he might eat the increase of the fields. He made them to suck honey out of the rock. In the clefts of the rock, the bees would make their nests, their hives. And so you could reach the honey out of the clefts of the rock, in that sense. And oil out of the flinty rock, because where no other trees would grow, the hardy olive tree would put down its roots. And either in bunches, in groups together, or individually, the olive tree would go. You get oil from the olive tree. Butter of kine, of the cows, milk of sheep, fat of lambs, rams of the breed of Bashan, and goats with the fat of kidneys of wheat. And thou didst drink the pure blood of the grape from the vineyards, as it were. The riches of the land. And that's only east of Jordan. They haven't even crossed over Jordan to inherit the promised land proper just yet. And the sense I think we should understand here is of, see how good the Lord is to you simply in this world, in this side of Jordan, the riches and the blessings of which he has delighted to give you here before even you cross over into the true promised land. This is how good God is. You don't want to get on the wrong side of a golden eagle. And you don't want to get on the wrong side of the Lord. But the care that the eagle has for her own young, her own children. Not all of them survive, of course. I mentioned earlier how they might lay four eggs and maybe one or two might survive in any season. And of course, of all those that are brought into contact with the gospel and may think, yeah, this is a good thing, I'll go with this. Think of the parable of the sower. Some of it sprung up quickly, but it withered away. Some maybe of the eggs that are laid, but maybe they never hatch. Or the hatch for the young don't survive. Not everyone that begins with the Lord goes on with the Lord. But if that is the case, if they do not survive, it is not for the eagle's lack of attention. It is not for the Lord's lack of love. It is either because we simply did not want that which the Lord offered, or because we desired to turn away back. The Lord will not have the enemy to think that he can triumph over his children. Were it not that I fear the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, lest they should say, our hand is high, we crushed the Israelites because we're strong, instead of because the Lord turned away from them. And so for this reason, he didn't abandon them entirely. Having let them drop, he would swoop down under them and pick them up again, as the eagle spreadeth abroad her wings, taketh them, beareth them on her wings. We desire to be borne on the wings of the wind, borne upon the wings of the Lord. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. The Lord will give you strength and grace to continue to the end of the way. But nothing else can. There is nothing else in this world which has eternal value in the way that the Lord's dealings with your soul have eternal value. As the eagle takes care of her young, the Lord, who is all-powerful, will take care of his children. And you may be in the nest for now and helpless, but he cares for you, and he feeds you, and he provides for you. And if the time comes when you must fall out of the nest, he will swoop beneath you. And he will bear you up until you can learn to fly and to cope with the problems, the difficulties, the dangers of this world. But he will always still be there. The Lord will never leave you nor forsake you. And however deep down you may fall, he will always be able to swoop beneath you. So the Lord alone did lead him. There was no strange God with him. Whatever the eagle does, God does better. Whatever her care of her young, the Lord's care is more loving, more gracious, more eternal. This is a picture. This is an illustration. But if the picture is vivid, and if the picture is good, how much greater must be the artist? And if the creature is impressive, how much more so the creator?